household. His mother had already called me her child, and she was making a tremendous sacrifice, spending possibly all their money for me. The whole family had taken it for granted that I loved Abek and that our happiness together was worth their sacrifice. A frightening thought crossed my mind. If I accepted their offer, it was clear that I must marry Abek. I visualized how it would all happen. I would be in Sosnovitz, with Abek's family for a while working in a shop, while Abek would paint day and night to secure a furlough. Then he would come home and get permission for me to go to Bielitz and work there in the camp kitchen. It might take weeks or months, but in the end Abek would get that permission. I imagined a hurried wedding in Sosnovitz before a rabbi, quickly before the Gestapo might knock, and everyone crying because my parents were not there. I imagined girls envying me for going to Bielitz, the camp where there would be no hard work and no hunger. I imagined the trip back with Abek. A guard would accompany us on our wedding journey. Perhaps he would be kind. Perhaps he would look away so we could exchange a kiss. At Bielitz we would get off at the station across from the place where Mama was taken away from me. I had visions of standing in the hot camp kitchen, preparing meals, looking through the windows over blooming meadows toward the home of my childhood. I saw myself standing over steaming tubs, washing clothes drenched with sweat and sometimes blood. So vivid were these pictures that I felt nauseated. I thought of Papa in Suche, the miracle of Mama being in Varovich, and my chance of being with them. I remembered the girl to whom I had given the food yesterday, who might no longer be alive. I remembered those breathing skeletons who had been shipped to Auschwitz to meet their death. It occurred to me that if I refused to marry Abek, he would never demand it against my wishes. But I couldn't accept his family's sacrifice and reject him. The certainty remained that if I accepted freedom now, I would have to marry Abek. I was young, a child in emotions and dreams. If I should live, I wanted perfection in marriage. I wanted the kind of love that I could imagine accompanied by flowers and laughter. With the vivid picture in mind of what the beginning of my married life with Abek would be, I ran to the office of the supervisor and told him that I would stay with my group. I watched him substitute another name on the shop permit. "I want to ask you a favor," I said, barely above a whisper. He looked at me. "Please don't let the family know that it was my decision."
"I won't," he replied, still looking at me and blotting the fresh ink.
Dazed, I went back to my bunk. Ilse was still at the window. "Ilse," I said, putting my hand on her shoulder, "I am staying with you." I heard my voice telling Ilse of my decision, but when I heard myself saying, "I am going to camp," the words became reality and I was panic-stricken. In a frenzy, I rushed back to the supervisor and begged him to allow me to leave, dreams and reasons forgotten. I had only one wish now, to get out from behind that barbed wire. But I was too late. The girl who had been given my permit had already left. When night fell, I felt strong pains tearing my abdomen. I had always suffered during menstruation. How I wished for a little hot water. I looked at Ilse. She was sleeping soundly, the first sleep she had had in several days. The night was hot and sticky. The straw in my bunk made it worse. The bristles stuck to my flesh, and the vermin gave me no rest. I tossed uneasily, and in pain and desperation I called, "Papa, Mama," but there was no comfort, only pain and loneliness. Then, suddenly, there was a slight breeze. It grew stronger, and a few heavy raindrops fell to the baked earth. The rain came faster and faster. The stifling room became cooler. I felt myself slowly relax and breathe more easily. The pain ceased, and the flow began, releasing with it some of my tension. Calmer now, I cried to the accompaniment of the falling rain. Chapter 3. On July 2, 1942, we were roused from our sleep and marched to the station to board the train that was to take us to camp. The streets were wet from the night's rain. The first rays of sunlight were breaking through, and the day gave promise of being a warm and brilliant one. Our marching feet echoed on the cobbled pavement as our column of 50 girls neared the station. While we waited under the canopied enclosure, I managed to send a note to Abek's family, telling them that I was sorry their plan had not worked, and that I would be forever grateful to them for their efforts. I wrote on the only piece of paper I possessed, a crumpled sheet in my pocket, and I asked one of the Militz men who accompanied us to mail it for me. I did not write to Abek. The gesture his family had made for me called for a different letter than I felt I could write. Although I was closer to Abek in this hour than ever before, I did everything to separate myself from him. We were about to board the train when I saw the Militz guard who had taken me to Abek's apartment hastily entering the station platform. He came directly to me. "The commander is interested in your staying in Sosnovitz. He did not realize that you would be sent out of the Julag so soon," he said a bit breathlessly. "Here is a message from him." He slipped a closed envelope into my hand. The girls in front of me were boarding the train. I was caught up in the shuffle and mounted the steps, Ilse close behind me. As we both stood at an open window, the Militz man called up to me from the platform. "The commander is a very influential man, you know." With an impulsive gesture, I tore the commander's unopened envelope into shreds and let them drop out the window. I enjoyed seeing the baffled expression on the Militz man's face. I smiled in triumph. It was wonderful to feel so important. As the train started up, Ilse and I sat next to each other, glad to leave Sosnovitz, even though we were uncertain about our future. The day must have quickly grown warm, for people we saw from the train moved slowly and with effort along the roads. Cattle were lying lazily in their pastures. We did not feel the heat because our window was open, letting the wind blow in. I almost enjoyed the journey. The two old SS men who accompanied us looked into our compartment every so often, but as the hours passed, they no longer bothered to come, perhaps because they had fallen asleep in another compartment. Our group occupied a whole car. When we stopped at stations, our doors were locked. People stared at us curiously through the windows. Ilse kept complaining of a headache. I noticed a tall, lovely girl in the corner of our compartment looking through all her pockets. She finally found what she was searching for and offered Ilse an aspirin tablet. After thanking her, Ilse introduced herself and then told her my name. "I am Sus Kunz," the girl replied with an accent that to me seemed Viennese. When I asked her about it, she told us that she had been born and raised in Vienna, but that the last few years she had lived in Czechoslovakia with her grandmother. She had a wonderful matter-of-fact cheeriness about her. "I am not worried a bit," she said. "Everything will be all right, much better than living in a ghetto, for sure. We are young and strong, and we can take a lot. What have we got to lose except our lives?" Sus was young and looked very strong. She had a healthy tanned complexion, flaming chestnut hair, and sparkling eyes. As I looked at her shyly, I wished she would become my friend. Ilse fell asleep, lulled by the motion of the train. Sus moved up to the window and leaned her elbows on the ledge beside me. "You know, I feel pretty good, in spite of everything," she confided. I knew exactly what she meant. The thing we feared most was done. We each had only ourselves to worry about. There would not be any more decisions to make. We spoke easily and understood each other. She asked about my parents, and then she told me that she and her father had been separated in Chechen. Her mother had died when she was born. She was an only child. The train puffed on. It became cooler as we approached the mountains. We talked away like old friends. "Won't it be fun when we make the journey back?" Sus said dreamily. "We will be free. Can you imagine how wonderful that will be?" "Yes," I was eager to agree. "It may be longer than we imagine," Sus said, her gaiety vanishing. "No, it won't be," I spoke quickly. Let's bet on it, she challenged. It will be longer than a year. Shorter than 6 months. I was confident. Let's bet a quart of strawberries and whipped cream payable after the war. I hope you win, Seuss shouted over the clatter of wheels.
Somewhere in the mountains of Silesia, we made a bet of strawberries and cream and solemnly shook hands. I lost that bet, but I never paid it, for gay, laughing Seuss died on the very morning of Liberation Day. My new friend and I remained at the window, thinking of liberation. Away from the Julag, I could believe that my parents were well, and that it would be only a matter of time before we were reunited. I wished the journey might never end. There was safety in motion. We seemed to be traveling in a southwesterly direction through eastern Germany. Late in the afternoon, after having covered perhaps 200 kilometers, the train stopped at a tiny, spotless station. The sign read, Birkenhain. The 2 SS guards got off and lined us up on the platform. A woman of about 40 briskly walked up to the SS man and, in a barking voice, identified herself as the Lagerführerin, or camp supervisor. Her first command to us was, Achtung, thundered through the station. We snapped to attention and looked into the face of the woman who would be in charge of us. She appeared grim and forbidding, with the face and jaws of a bulldog. Her brown hair was tightly curled, and she was dressed in mourning. Looking at her uncommunicative face, I could feel fear creeping into me. Her harsh appearance turned out to conceal a kind heart, but we did not learn this until much later. We were counted and marched out of the station and through the little town. It was hilly and reminded me of Bielitz. So this was the homeland of Nazism. People looked at us as though they had not expected us to be human. Children were called into houses. One young blonde woman stood at an open window watering flowers in the window box as we passed. She interrupted her task and looked at us wide-eyed. The thought came to me that she had probably never seen a Jew in her life. Brought up under the Nazis, she expected us to be monsters. What a shock it must have been to find us looking very much like herself, some of us quite pretty. One woman stood in front of her home, broom in hand, and glared at us with cold hatred. Perhaps, I thought, she had lost a son in the war. Their propaganda told them that the Jews were responsible for the war, so she hated us. I saw an old man on a porch, smoking a long-stemmed pipe. We passed close by. There seemed to be pity in his eyes, and I noticed a slow, almost imperceptible shaking of his head. As we approached the factory, we turned off the road where it widened and marched into a paved yard before the long, modern, well-kept buildings. I read the firm's name in large gold letters over the entrance, Kromster Mettner Furne, and under it, Weberei, weaving mill. After we lined up, one of the SS men disappeared into the factory. He soon reappeared, bringing with him the man who had picked us in the Dulag in Sosnowitz. I heard the Lagerführerin address him as Herr Direktor. The director handed the Lagerführerin a roster and told her to read off our names. We were to reassemble in alphabetical order, he said. When he handed her the list, he called her Frau Kugler. Frau Kugler read off our names. We were all present. Then the director signed a sheet of paper, handed him by one of the SS men. The merchandise was delivered. The SS men clicked their heels, lifted right arms. Heil Hitler, they boomed. Heil Hitler, echoed the director and Frau Kugler. Without wasting a moment, Frau Kugler marched us alongside the factory. At the end of the long building, we came to a stop. A high gate with barbed wire strung along the top stood open, and we marched through into another courtyard which ran along the end of the factory. I was one of the last in the column, and behind me the gate of our prison clanged shut. Frau Kugler locked and bolted it. Locked up, I felt deprived and helpless. Beyond our high-wire fence stretched beautiful gardens, reaching far into the pine-wooded hills. There, against the slopes, stood the stately white villa of the director. Presently the director appeared in our enclosure. I watched him as he stood near me, a tall, handsome man in his early 40s, with sleek dark hair and a small, carefully clipped mustache. He smiled a bit ironically as he let his eyes wander about our group.
"Let us pick the personnel," he said to Frau Kugler.
They conferred a while, scanning the roster for suggestions that must have been made in the Julag.
"Malvin Berger,"
Frau Kugler barked, and a tall, red-haired woman, much older than the rest of us, stepped forward.
"Judenel Desta."
We knew that there always was a senior Jewess in charge of a group like ours, and that she would be directly responsible to the Lagerführerin. The cook was chosen, a slender woman of about 30 with light blonde hair drawn back into a bun. Two girls for kitchen help were next, both wearing glasses, then the Sanitaterin, or nurse. There were two girls among us who had been nurses. They were told to step forward, but only one was chosen. Although I did not catch her last name, I made out that her first was Litzi. I liked her. She had jet-black hair, smiling eyes, and dimples. Her appointment made me glad. Apparently they cared about our health. The director announced that we would be taught to weave. If we behaved and worked hard, all would be well. If not, we would be sent back to the Julag.
"And I can get enough replacements from the Julag," he observed with a smile on his lips. "You are to obey your Lagerführerin and your Judenälteste."
With that, he turned and summoned Mrs. Berger. He spoke to her for a moment, and I saw Mrs. Berger nod assent. Then she stepped in front of us and said, "Girls, I hope you know what our position is here. How we feel is beside the point. We have to please the people here. Whoever breaks the rules will be punished by me personally, in addition to all other punishment, since one can do harm to all of us by her behavior. I will be stern." Her speech was clipped, her German excellent. She made it clear where we stood. She dared to say, "How we feel is beside the point." At that remark, I saw how the director knit his brow. Thus, she made our captors understand that we were no fools. Nor was there any humble begging in her manner. Whatever else she might be like, I could tell that she possessed intelligence, integrity, and courage, and I liked her very much. In the months to come, when in the course of our trials I got to know her better, I was often annoyed by her pettiness and her desire to shine. Yet the qualities I had first recognized in her never fell short of my estimate. She had daring, and she often baffled people so that they could not refuse her requests. I am convinced that in part, at least, we have to thank Mrs. Berger for a relatively easy time at Kramster. Bolkenhain soon gained a reputation as one of the best labor camps for women in Germany. After Mrs. Berger had addressed us, we were led to our quarters in a building joined to the factory by means of the fenced courtyard. I entered the low building with a prayer in my heart. I had expected another Julag, but was pleasantly surprised to find that everything was fresh and clean. We were obviously the first occupants. Our room was large, perhaps 40 by 50 feet. Near the entrance stood several long tables, flanked by benches. The remainder of the room was mainly taken up by rows of three-tiered bunks with clean gray blankets and a straw-filled pillow on each, as well as a coarse towel. The far right end of the room was divided into two parts. One of these was the kitchen, the other a washroom with a row of faucets over a long trough, three toilets and three showers. Near the entrance to the kitchen was a separate small room for Frau Kugler. At the far left end of the main room was a tiny cubicle which was to be known as Mrs. Berger's room, and next to it was another larger room where Litzi was to sleep, with three bunks reserved for the ill. We called our quarters the Lager, or camp, and I promptly named our bunks the Catacombs. Somehow the name stuck. Ilse and I had adjoining bunks, two up from the floor. Beneath us were two girls from Bielitz, and I noted with pleasure that Suze Kuntz was assigned the bunk above me. We were given warm soup in new bowls and hunks of well-baked bread. If only we could be certain that our parents were in a camp like ours. After supper we were allowed to wash. The water was cold. We learned that it was heated only once a week. After that we were free to go to sleep, for which we were all grateful.
However, few of us slept. After the lights were turned out, I heard girls toss and turn and here and there weep quietly. The night was starry and beautiful. From my bunk, I could see the hills through a window. Slowly, the full moon rose. I spoke dreamily to her. I asked her if she saw Papa and Mama. It seemed as if she said yes. In the years to come, the moon became my loyal friend, my only friend that was free. Each month I counted the days until she returned, and often when she hid behind clouds, I thought that she was avoiding the horror on earth. That first night in Bolkenhain, I whispered to her, "Say good night to my loved ones," and went to sleep under her watchful gaze. Chapter 4. A shrill whistle sounded at 5:30 a.m. I sat upright in my bunk, rubbed my eyes, and had to think where I was. We went to wash. When I returned to my bunk, I saw Mrs. Berger slap a girl. I turned away. Suddenly I hated her. There is nothing I despise more than physical violence. Later, Mrs. Berger told me that she had to do it to establish her authority. The girl had not gotten up when called, therefore she had to be punished immediately. I disagreed, but I must admit that in the next 3 years she rarely used violence. That first morning she won respect, or rather fear, from us, but a great deal of hatred as well. We were marched past the kitchen and handed a slice of bread with beet marmalade and a cup of coffee, a bitter brew made of wheat. After breakfast, Frau Kugler handed each of us 3 yellow stars, each with the inscription, "Jew." One was to be fastened on the breast, one on the back, and one on top of a kerchief tied around the head so that one could tell who we were from any angle. Shortly before 7, we marched to the factory with Frau Kugler, entering the hall containing about 25 looms. We lined up along a wall and waited. After a few minutes, Meister Zimmer, a man in a clean blue working uniform, entered. As he stood in the center of the room, his hands on a loom, he seemed grotesque. He reminded me of the big posters plastered on walls at every street corner. "The men who turn the wheels for victory, the pillars of the Reich." His voice was harsh, precise, and well-trained. He told us that we were here to work for Germany and the glorious Nazi Party. If we did our share, we would be able to stay for the rest of our lives and be well treated. If we failed or did anything that would not conform to German ideology, we would be looked upon as traitors. "And what is done with traitors, you know," he thundered. "Those who cannot work for our victory are not needlessly fed. Those we exterminate." Our parents, useless, not worth 3.5 Reichsmark anymore. Anger shot through me. I clenched my fists. He kept on talking, repeating that we could stay for life. He was so positive, so reassuring, that I felt myself falling under the spell of his words. Not only would he teach us to weave, but he felt he should teach us decency and how to be a part of the program for the glory of the Führer and the Fatherland. Decency was a word by which my parents lived. Used by this man, it became ugly. I tried to concentrate on what he was saying. "He talks about staying here forever," I thought. "He is at least 30 years older than I. He will die long before I do." With pleasure, I imagined how he would look dead, worms eating his ears. What strange, confused ideas crossed my mind. I must have smiled because Ilse poked my side. "Are you crazy?" she whispered. "You smiled. Luckily he did not see you." Those first days in Bolkenhain were difficult. We worked in the factory classroom from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. The heat bothered us, our ankles were swollen from standing, our eyes strained from watching the thousands of threads. I was afraid that if something went wrong with my loom, I should be blamed. Meister Zimmer watched us constantly, popping up in unexpected places. But though he was fairer than I at first thought he would be, I always hated him with all my heart. Sunday came, the first at Bolkenhain. On Sundays we got meat stew, and we were permitted to write one one-page letter. I wrote to Papa as Suka,
in care of the head of the Jewish community. I described our camp in glowing colors. I expressed my opinion that Mama might be with him, or in a camp similar to mine. Somehow I believed it. I asked him to write to Abek and tell him where I was, and I told him how wonderful Abek's parents had been to me. I begged him to write to me right away, to tell me how he was, and to take good care of himself. I think I closed the letter on a cheerful note. Ilsa and I washed our clothes, fastened the stars back on them, and cleaned around our bunks. Those were tasks I did not like, and Ilsa urged me to leave them to her. "Go talk to the girls," she would say. "Then tell me about them. You can't clean properly anyway." I loved to talk to the girls, to hear their stories, and gladly I let Ilsa spoil me. After a week's training in the classroom, we began work on the factory's regular looms. We were especially tense and frightened when Meister Zimmer told us that each mistake would or could be counted as an act of sabotage. He had been an excellent teacher, I had to admit, but I was sure that he had been chosen for his position as foreman, not only for his practical knowledge of weaving, but also because of the fanatical way in which he loved to spread the Nazi doctrine. We worked hard. At first each of us tended one loom, then we were assigned two, then three looms, and finally we watched four. Experts who had spent their lives weaving never handled more than three looms. It was grueling work, necessitating constant running, and it caused severe eye strain. The noise of the looms deafened us for hours after we stopped working. The material we worked with was bad. Sometimes we wove paper. It would tear and break constantly. In the heat, it became dry and brittle. In damp weather, it became moist and fell to pieces. How I worked those first weeks, I will never know. My fingers worked without conscious direction. I worked mechanically and watched the movement of the clock's hands. I waited for the evening for the mail call. In time, most of the girls heard from relatives in cities which had not yet met the fate of Bielitz. Ilsa corresponded with an aunt who remained in Bielitz. Having been married to a Christian, the aunt had been allowed to stay. I waited anxiously every night when Mrs. Berger came in with the mail, but I waited in vain. Our second Sunday came, and this time I wrote to Abek. I thanked him and his parents for all they had done for me. I asked him about Papa and Mama and begged him to write to Arthur. It took 3 or 4 days for our mail to leave Bolkenhain, for Frau Kugler censored it all. The following week I waited for mail from Papa, but night after night nothing came. Then Saturday came. "Oh, God," I prayed as Mrs. Berger came out of her room with a pile of mail. Mrs. Berger started distributing the letters. When I heard her call Goethe, I jumped up, but it was for another Goethe, Goethe Feldman. The pile of letters grew smaller and smaller. Mrs. Berger looked at her last letter. Quite a few pairs of eyes watched her anxiously. I felt a burning and twitching inside. Then her eyes wandered over the girls. She halted when she saw me, and said the unbelievable, "Goethe Weissmann?" I grabbed the letter from her hand. My moist eyes spotted Papa's name. I ran to the fence outdoors. I wanted to read it alone. As I started to tear it open, I suddenly realized that the beloved name on the envelope was written in my handwriting. Over it, in black ink, was, "Return to sender, moved without forwarding address." I wanted to scream, but no sound came. I wanted to cry, but no tears came. I clutched the barbed wire and shook feverishly. I wanted to run out, to run and look for my father. Ilsa joined me. She did not ask any questions, but looked instead at the unopened envelope in my hand. She wanted to talk to me, but I would not listen, and I couldn't speak. Finally, she went to Mrs. Berger and told her about the returned letter. Mrs. Berger summoned me to her room. I stood there, and she questioned me, but I could not answer her. Finally, she told me to sit down on her bed. As I did so, she slapped me.
Instinctively, my hand went up to my cheek. I shook my head. "I'm sorry," she said. "I wanted to jolt you out of it." I started to leave, but Mrs. Berger took me by the shoulder and turned me around. With her cold eyes, she looked into mine and she held me. "Talk, Goethe," she said. "Speak to me." I shook my head. She released the pressure and pushed me toward a chair. She showed me a picture of a man and a boy. "This is my husband and my son," she said. "I don't know where they are, either of them. We are all in the same boat. Have you any pictures?" I went to get a couple of snapshots which I had in my coat pocket. "Show me your father," she said. I had a picture of Papa taken a few years before when he had gone to Turkey for my uncle's wedding. The picture was taken during a boat ride on the Bosporus. It was Papa at his best, young, handsome, and energetic. Not my poor, sick Papa. Full of pride, I held his picture out to Mrs. Berger, while in my other hand I held the letter he had not received. She looked at the picture a while, and then she put it back into my hand. "Look at the picture, Goethe," she commanded, "for your father is dead." I looked at the picture. I looked at her. "He is dead," she repeated. "You will never see him again, nor your mother." "Dead" imprinted itself in my brain. My lips formed to say the word, but no sound came. "Cry, Goethe," Mrs. Berger persisted. "Cry for your dead father." Then something within me snapped, something wild and horrible. I made a terrible sound, the sound a dying animal might make, the sound Papa made the day Arthur left. It shook me out of my muteness. Without a tear, I cried for my father. My sobbing tore my insides. It pulled at my heart, but my eyes remained dry. When I calmed down, Mrs. Berger sent me to my bunk. Ilse was most understanding. She said nothing. Finally, the lights were put out. Some of the girls whispered a bit. Then silence fell, and in this silence I started to think of home again. Not of the ghetto nor the cellar, but our home as it had been before the war. I thought of Papa, Mama, and Arthur, and all the happy times we had had together. These happy thoughts were comforting. Memory upon memory, things long forgotten, came back to life. And from that night on, whenever I thought of my parents, I thought of them in the happy times before the war, their faces perfect, not distorted by sorrow and hurt. Too perfect, perhaps, for ordinary life, too perfect for an adult eye and mind, but so right for me. Slowly I fell into an exhausted sleep on that horrible day. My parents were so alive in my mind that I could see them coming into my room and bending over my bed to kiss me good night. I smiled, stretched my arms out to them. My lips formed the first word that I had ever spoken. Papa. Chapter 5. It was in August that I first wrote to Abeck, begging him to tell me if he had heard from Papa. Shortly thereafter, I received mail from Abeck, and from then on his letters came almost daily. Abeck had heard from Papa right after our separation. He told me that he had tried and failed to get Papa into the camp where he was interned in Bilitz. Papa had written me a letter and left it with Abeck. I asked Abeck to forward the letter to me, yet I waited for it in vain. In his next letter, he told me how distressed his parents were about their failure to keep me in Sosnowitz, but he made no mention of Papa's letter. When he finally sent it, I knew why he had not wanted me to read it. The nervous scribbling only faintly reminded me of Papa's firm, energetic hand. Papa asked me why I had left Mama. That question, written in his shaken hand, burned within me for years, for Papa never learned the answer to it. Abeck's letters were mostly romantic and far removed from everyday life. Sometimes there would only be a couple of lines, such as, "It is 528 hours since I last saw you. How am I to stand it much longer?" I remember the day when he wrote that he had been one of a group to go to the Bilitz ghetto to clean out several rooms. He came across a few family photographs in a drawer in our former apartment, and he said that he would send them to me in his next letter.
It was a hot, hot day late in summer, and I had a splitting headache. The looms were behaving badly, the brittle yarn kept breaking, and I wasn't able to maintain the required rate of production. The harder I tried, the more I fell behind. My feet and ankles were swollen. I felt utterly discouraged. Then the worst possible thing happened. I heard a noise and crash, and the shuttle leapt up from the cloth web like a silver fish. As it dropped, it tore thousands of warp threads. I stood speechless, unable to imagine how it had happened. I examined the shuttle and saw that the lid was off the bobbin holder. Either it had broken off, or perhaps in my haste, when refilling it, I had not closed it securely. Desperately, with shaking fingers, I tried to repair the damage before I was discovered, but I knew that it would take hours. When the whistle blew at quitting time, my loom was still not in order. That night, I didn't feel like eating and went to my bunk to lie down. Mrs. Berger came by and handed me two letters from Abeck. As I opened the first, a few pictures fell out, the ones that Abeck had found. One was of Papa's father, taken when he was a very old man. He had a high forehead and a long white beard. I had never known Grandpa Weissman, because he had died when I was less than a year old. Papa had told us many stories about his father, but the one which I remembered filled me with new miraculous faith. He and my grandmother had 10 children, 5 of whom died at an early age. My father was the oldest of the remaining children. During the First World War, my grandparents lived on the Austro-Russian frontier. Anna, their only daughter, lived with them, and their 4 sons were in the Austrian army. The border area changed hands frequently, and in 1915 became Russian again. One day, Grandfather, who was then in his 70s, went for a walk in the woods. He met a group of drunken Russian soldiers who accused him of laying telephone wires through the woods. I'm sure Grandfather had never seen or heard a telephone in his life. Nevertheless, without a trial, he was convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment in Siberia. I recall my grandmother telling me of the day when she and my Aunt Anna said their last goodbye to the kindly old man with his long white beard. Years passed, the war ended, my father's 3 brothers returned home. Papa had married meanwhile and moved to Bielitz. Then one windy, cold evening, my grandmother, who was living with her younger sons and daughter, heard a knock on their front door. They opened the door, and an old man staggered in. He first went to his precious Bibles and kissed them. Then he embraced his wife and children. My grandfather had come back. After the revolution, the Bolsheviks had granted amnesty to Tsarist prisoners, and Grandfather, after many months' journey, had returned home. He had hardly dared to hope that all his sons would survive the war. They all had. Always with a quiver in his voice, Papa would tell how he, Mama, and Arthur, 1 year old at the time, had traveled 4 days by train across the war-ravaged countryside to see Grandfather. The old man had greeted Papa with the words Jacob had spoken when Joseph had brought his children for benediction. I had not thought to see thy face again, and lo, God hath shewed me also thy seed. As I looked at the picture in the dim light of my bunk, my kindly old grandfather seemed to be saying, "Have faith, my child, have faith in God." Meister Zimmer appeared at my looms the next morning. Before he spoke, he looked first at me and then at the damage. He must have realized how hard I had worked to repair the broken threads, for he only said in his most abrupt manner, "See that this never happens again." Early in September, I got my first letter from Arthur. "At last," I whispered to myself, tearing it open. Yet this letter that I had looked forward to so long left me troubled. Arthur wrote that he was working and was well, and that his only worry was for my welfare. However, there was something about the letter that was not Arthur. Strength, hope, and vitality seemed to have been drained from him. Even the writing of the message seemed to have been a tremendous chore. When I answered him the following Sunday, I tried to be cheerful in order to break down the barrier that had risen between us. I asked whether he was ill, whether there was something he was keeping from me. His next letter was the same, almost word for word, as the first. I was distressed. Ilse's warm friendship and the long talks I had with her and Seuss helped a great deal to overcome my worry about Arthur. Talking with the other girls and hearing their problems helped, too. There was one Bielitz girl, Greta, whom I liked in particular. She was always cheerful. "You know," she said to me one day, "I actually was never happier than now." I gasped in sheer disbelief, and then she told me her story. She had been born out of wedlock. Her mother had always worked, and Greta had never had a home. She had drifted from family to family. Some children were not allowed to play with her. "I looked at all those kids," she said, "and you were probably among them, with your frilly dresses, your patent leather shoes, your fretting nannies and doting parents. I always was on the outside. Now, finally, we are equals. Yes, it's true, I have never been happier than I am now." We had been in camp for 3 months when Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, came. We all said that we would fast. Meister Zimmer somehow heard about it. He warned that severe punishment would be meted out to anyone who feigned illness or did not produce the prescribed amount of material. Nevertheless, we all fasted. We worked harder than ever, but no one touched food until there were 3 stars in the evening sky. There was a proud serenity about every one of us, a sense of accomplishment. That night the heat was unbearable. I could not sleep, and after tossing in my bunk for a long while, I went out into the courtyard. The air was heavy. In the distance, the hills were dark against the rising full moon. The stillness was frightening. The world seemed to be awaiting judgment day. I pressed my head against the wire fence and prayed. Then I noticed 2 girls clinging to the fence near me. One of them was named Tusia. She was tall, thin, and ugly. I am sure that I never quite understood her, but when she spoke, I could not help but listen. She reminded me of a giraffe. Her small head was set on a long neck, her round eyes were far apart, her mouth was full and wide. She walked toward me and looked down in her peculiar way. "I was very much like you," she said. "I hope you will never be disillusioned. To you, life still means beauty, and that is how it should be. Continue to go through mud without dirtying your feet." She spoke without explanation or introduction and without finishing, and then she stalked away toward our quarters. I heard stifled crying and turned back to the fence. The 2nd girl was still there. She was Lotte, one of the girls who worked in the kitchen. I walked over to her and waited without saying a word. Her sobs stopped, and she wiped away the tears from behind her thick glasses. "It would have been so different," she whispered. Then she told me her story. "My mother left my father when I was a few weeks old. We went to live with my grandmother. Mother was wealthy, but my father gambled. The night I was born, father lost our house playing cards. Shortly after that, mother left him. She never spoke of him until one day when I was 7, she called me into a room and asked if I wanted to meet my father. I had often thought about him, but never dared to ask mother if what the servants had whispered was true. My heart beat wildly. I had never dared to hope that I would meet him. I had heard that he traveled a lot, but he had never come to our town. 'He is not here,' mother said. 'You will go to another town to see him.' I couldn't sleep that night. Would I really see my daddy? What was it like to meet one's real father? How would he look? What would he say? What would he buy me? I made the journey with my nurse. We came to his hotel, and when she knocked at father's door, I held on to her firmly. Suddenly the door burst open, and before I could utter a word, a tall man lifted me high and kissed me over and over again. I felt a peculiar tickling on my face. It was Daddy's beard. I had never felt the face of a man before. It was the most wonderful day of my life. I got more dolls and toys that day than ever before in my entire life. He bought me sweets and let me eat all I wanted, something Mother never permitted. It was like a birthday and a circus rolled into one. I had found my daddy. When we left, and I cried, he said to me lovingly, "I shall see you again soon, my darling." Mother was anxious to hear all the details of my visit. Soon letters, cards, and presents started to pour in. From faraway places, Daddy sent everything that a little girl could dream of. He was an engineer. He built bridges and traveled from England to many countries in Europe. Then, more than a year later, he wrote that he was coming back home. And would Mama and I meet him? Mother was very excited. She bought a new green hat and looked very pretty. We met Daddy and had dinner together. How happy I was! Lydia stopped talking. Her hand clutched the fence as she gazed into the starry night as if to recapture that dinner when she was 8 years old, and for the first time she sat at the same table with both her parents. "How happy I was," she repeated, tears glistening in her eyes behind her thick glasses. Before Daddy left, he saw Mother alone. Then he called me and said, "I'm going back to England to wait for a letter from your mother. When it comes, we shall always be together." In the next few days, Mother wrote the letter. A few days later, an enthusiastic telegram came. Daddy just had a few business details to take care of, and then he would come to get us. We started packing feverishly. We were to make our home in England with Daddy. Then a few days later, a second telegram came. Mama tore it open quickly. She went pale. Daddy had been killed in a train wreck on his journey to us. On his body, they had found Mother's letter with an address. That was the story of Lottie's childhood. The rest of her life story I can tell in its entirety. We went from camp to camp. In February 1945, on the infamous death march to Czechoslovakia, I saw Lottie's corpse thrown into a hastily dug mass grave. Her glasses gone, her eyes half open, a sad smile on her lips. I saw the frozen earth thrown onto her. That was Lottie. I cannot help but want to tell her story, for I might be the only one left in the world who knows it. The days grew colder. Fall came. In November, Abek sent me a big parcel containing warm clothes, a coat, a sweater, a scarf. He thought of everything. I still had my skiing shoes Papa had insisted I wear, and so I was prepared for cold weather. One evening, as we marched from the factory to our quarters, it was snowing. Later that night, when the lights were put out, I got up from my bunk and walked noiselessly to the window. I watched the first snow fall softly to the ground. Pictures from the past came to me, a crackling fire, Papa smoking his pipe, Mama embroidering in exciting, bright hues, silk wound around her white, swiftly moving fingers, Arthur reading, I playing with my cats, Schmutzi, my favorite, purring gently. Wonderful days and evenings. I marveled that we had taken life so for granted. Christmas approached. We could feel the hustle and bustle in the factory. Goebbels was feeding his people with reports of new victories to make Christmas more pleasant. The day before Christmas, we were assigned to clean the looms thoroughly. It was bitter cold, and the vast halls were not heated. My fingers froze to the iron bars suspended between the looms. My throat filled with the year's accumulation of lint and dust that we brushed away. I was cold through and through, and I looked eagerly forward to a shower and something hot to drink. When we got back to our quarters late Christmas Eve, the hot water had been turned off. We learned that we had to get up early and finish the cleaning on Christmas morning, and that after that we would get 2 days off. Frozen and shivering, we went back to work in the early hours of the morning and were done by noon. Then we were allowed to take hot showers. How delicious the water felt on my body! It warmed me and made my pale skin glow. It washed away the dirt and fatigue. Ahead stretched 2 full free days. As I combed my hair by the window, I saw bright sunshine on the snow. Quickly, I put on my coat to go out to the courtyard. On my way, I met Mrs. Berger. "Oh, Goethe," she called, walking back toward her room. "There is mail for you from yesterday." It was a letter from Arthur. I passed several girls throwing snowballs and walked over to the fence before I opened the envelope. It contained a frayed, dirty piece of paper covered with a few uneven lines. Arthur was in a camp. I should not worry. He would try to write again. A strange sensation came over me. That piece of paper seemed alive. Like Erica's letter of long ago, it throbbed with suffering. I knew that Arthur was not in a camp like Bolkenhain. "Arthur," I whispered, "why were you not spared?" And there in Bolkenhain on Christmas Day, 1942, when the sun stood high at noon, the snow brilliant at my feet, I heard people outside the gates laughing as they came from church, children jingling gay sleigh bells. And there in the glaring sunlight I suddenly knew that I would never see Arthur again. Every jingle, every laugh, brought back a picture of my brother to me. Arthur painting with a green stain on his thumb. Arthur skiing over the brilliant snow, his navy blue sweater showing his powerful muscles. Arthur, the center of a group, laughing, frowning, forehead wrinkled, then a flashing smile. Arthur swimming, his hair wet, sunshine flecking his merry eyes. Arthur kissing Mama's hand when he left us. Arthur leaving home that morning without looking back. Arthur, my rock of strength. I fumbled for the little sack that I wore around my neck under my blouse. I opened it and looked at the piece of broken glass that we had gathered from the ruins of the temple. Arthur. Arthur. Upset and bitter, I wrote to Abek and poured out my grief to him. After New Year's, I got his answer. He could not understand why I carried on so. I knew that he loved me and would willingly have endured hardships for me, yet because he and his immediate family were still safe, he could not comprehend. He told me that he had been home over Christmas, and he described how happy his family had been to be together. He was not callous, he merely shared his experiences with me, but I was jealous of his being home. I was bitter that I could not see Arthur, for I felt that only he could fully understand me. I was hurt by Abek's letter, sorry that I had not stayed in Sosnovyets, sorry for myself. A week or two later, I began to feel ill. I went to see Litsi, the nurse. She told me that my temperature was high, but that nothing else seemed wrong. So it went for a week or more until the nails of my hands and feet became infected and full of pus. My temperature rose again, and Litsi said that I had better not go to the factory, but stay in the Krankenrefuhr. I felt no pain, only terrible fatigue. Yet I could not sleep. I wanted to cry, but no tears came. I had been in Litsi's room 2 days, when in the morning after the girls had marched off to the factory, Frau Kugler hurried in, flushed and excited. There were 2 other ill girls in the room with me. "Get dressed," she said. "Quick, quick." "Goethe can't," Litsi told her. "Her fever is very high." Frau Kugler ignored Litsi and pulled me back from the bunk. "Hurry, hurry," she urged, and they all helped me dress. Frau Kugler tied my shoes. My knees trembled. The few feet to the door seemed to be an enormous distance. Cold sweat ran down my forehead as I walked. I felt cold all over. Frau Kugler led the 3 of us to the factory. We kept close to the wall as we went. She followed me to my looms and set them in motion. "Keep going, Goethe," she muttered under her breath as she turned to go. I felt as if I had just gotten off a merry-go-round. I could not see the looms. The light fell queerly in ugly yellow stripes. The machines seemed to stand at an angle. At times the looms seemed far away, as if I were looking at them through the wrong end of binoculars. The next instant the threads rushed toward me as if to entangle me. I started forward, and then I swayed. Someone caught me in strong arms and shouted into my ear, "Pull yourself together, Goethe. It is a matter of life or death." As the words reached me, I shuddered almost beyond caring. Then I gripped the beating loom and looked into Frau Kugler's eyes. "Pull yourself together," she repeated, and then vanished. After a few minutes, I saw the factory director walking nearby with a tall, stern-looking SS Obersturmführer. I knew he must be Lindner. I had heard in the Julag that he was the most notorious sadist of all. Those who were ill he sent directly to Auschwitz. Then I knew why Frau Kugler had hastily led us to the factory. My hand felt steady. When Glindner passed me, I stood erect, my looms all in motion. Somehow I lived through that day. The last thing I remember was the coolness of a sheet against my burning body. When I woke up, there was a great stillness that I had not experienced in many months. I sensed that it was late and that I was again in Litzy's room. Frau Kugler came in. I looked at her, remembering. "Thank you," I whispered.
"It's all right," she touched my hand. "Who knows?"
She broke off there, and as she went out of the door, I looked after her in wonder. The German woman who worked for the SS had saved my life. I got well fast, resumed the old routine. In a way, I began to like my work. I found a new security in it, for the intricate process of weaving gave me a sense of satisfaction and accomplishment. Late in January, I got another message from Arthur. I was shocked, so sure had I been that the letter I read on Christmas Day was his farewell to me. I hardly recognized his handwriting. The words looked as though his hands were stiff or frozen, or as if he had written in darkness. He just said that I should not worry and that I should be strong. He did not say what he was doing or where he was. Somehow that jumbled little note reassured me. It had some quality of the Arthur I knew, and I was calmer after I got it. It proved to be the last message I ever got from my brother. Perhaps he knew or sensed it would be. Perhaps he paid for writing it with life itself. His quiet words gave me the strength and trust to go on and face what was to come. Chapter 6. Several days later, Abeck wrote, the thing he had hoped would not happen had happened. His parents and sisters were gone. The Jews of Sosnowitz had met the same fate as those in Bielitz and elsewhere. He had managed to get to Sosnowitz, but by the time he arrived, no one was left. Even the young people had been sent to Auschwitz and not to work camps. Abeck described what he thought had happened, down to the last cruel, unthinkable detail. He told me that he had seen the large field where his family and thousands of others had stood before their last journey. He imagined how the place must have echoed with cries only the day before. He described the bodies still lying in the field, dead from cold, starvation, or suicide. There were many bodies of children whose parents had given them poison or sleeping pills so that they could be spared Auschwitz. I lived it all through Abeck's eyes until I felt that I could take no more. I forced myself to read all his letter. My life is a desert now, he wrote. I go on living only because I have you. Only you can make a future possible for me. When I hold you in my arms again, we will both cry our bitterness away. You will wipe away my tears and make me happy. You will teach me to smile again. Through you I might yet know some happiness. When I put down the letter, I felt anew all the pain I had suffered at separation from Papa and Mama. I was afraid of the future. Abeck's parents were gone, too, and I felt closer to them than to Abeck. They were no more. I could hardly grasp it. With horror, I remembered how I had battled with myself in the Julag. Had I stayed in Sosnowitz and not been able to get back to Bielitz, I would have been sent to Auschwitz, too. I sat down at once and wrote to Abeck. I wrote what he would want to hear, that I would be with him, that I would never leave him, that I would make him happy. I wrote slowly and deliberately, not in my usual swift, careless way. I was halfway finished when the lights in our quarters were turned off for the night. In the washroom, in the dim blue light there, I wrote the rest. I wrote without looking back, without correcting. I had to finish it without stopping. Timidly, I knocked on Frau Kugler's door and asked her if my one weekly letter might be mailed ahead of time. To my surprise, she was not angry. She promised to send it off in the morning. I returned to my bunk, undressed slowly, and neatly folded my things away, something that I had never done before. When I got into the bunk, I felt Ilsa's hand reaching for mine. The gesture annoyed me.